Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation and introduction. I return the favor. I really enjoyed the conversations, and I hope we can deepen them. And as you will see, I'm looking, as a neuroscientist who is interested in the mind, I'm looking towards physics and mathematics and engineering, yeah? Because we don't know the models and the mechanisms. So, and I will start you, so I will start right away. Of course, you are well familiar with what questions, what is the brain? And I want to start my talk with sort of the kind of model, a very simplified model of brain, which is often presupposed in neuroscience, and which I think raises some problems. The guiding question of my talk is really, how can the brain, or Arthur Schopenhauer, German philosopher in the 19th century, spoke of a gray pulpy device, how can the brain yield something like mental features, like consciousness, experience, or maybe you hear me and you hear my strong accent and you say, oh, you're not interested in the topic, you have a feeling of boredom. So how is that possible? How can neuronal activity transform into mental activity? You will see that question is already very provocatively formulated. So the traditional model of the brain, oops, oh, I apparently took out, okay. The traditional model of the brain is really that the brain is a purely reflex apparatus, it's a purely mechanical device. So it functions, here you have a certain stimulus input, here's the Colosseum of Rome, and with that you see, or like see, you see me now, you have a stimulus input, and then certain activity is generated in your brain. So that's what we usually call stimulus or task-evoked activity, and that by itself is, of course, no surprise. However, what is important, that often neuroscience, also these days, you see the fancy brain imaging data, that this activity is supposed to be sufficiently related to the stimulus, meaning the activity is completely caused or changed sufficiently by that stimulus. And then, of course, the question arises, how is it possible that you associate this stimulus with a certain experience, a feeling, a sense of self? Ah, I have been there to Rome. Ah, and you have a wonderful experience. You remember all the experience. Because nothing of that is in the stimulus included. Yeah? Consciousness does not come with a stimulus. So if you say that this activity is sufficiently related to this, of course you have to raise the question, there must be something special add-on that causes consciousness. Yeah? And then you basically, it leaves by default a gap. Yeah? And that's exactly what current neuroscience is really suffering. Yeah? So that's the really most standard model. And so I don't know, I skipped the first picture. So, but now imagine you step out of the car and you, for you as a physicist, this is nothing special what I say, you step out of this building, you see your bike or your car is not yet a self-driving vehicle, probably spontaneously driving back and forth. Yeah, and you say, oh wow, this is crazy, I need to call the psychiatrist for cars. Yeah, so it moves back and forth a certain spatial-temporal trajectory. And that will be basically the topic of my talk. So there's a certain spontaneity, a certain spontaneous activity. And that's exactly what your brain does. It's continuously, spontaneously active, indicated here by the orange line, and meaning that your activity here is a mixture, it's a hybrid between these two. Yeah? And that interaction we haven't understood. One major line of our research is studying that interaction. Because we assume that that interaction carries some insight about when and when not this stimulus will be associated with consciousness. Yeah? So it's not just, as I like to say, consciousness does not come with the stimulus, but consciousness is assigned to the stimulus by the brain. And that might sound not strange to you. For many neuroscientists who always looked, started from here just with the stimulus and looked here, this is a complete reversal of them. Yeah? So you might have heard a sort of the cognitive view that. So my talk is mostly about this guy. Yeah? just these five lines that my talk is about, nothing else. Because the idea is first, decipher these kind of patterns, space-time dynamics. Secondly, how they are related to mental features. So, how can we characterize, this is more a conceptual thing, this brain spontaneous activity, and that has also strong philosophical, historical predecessors, as you will see. It's neither fully passive. There was a long model of, going back to David Hume and John Locke, that the mind, also now carried forward to the brain in our times, that it's purely passive, it's just receptive. Sensory processing is just a stimulus, and it's just passively processing. That's not true. You have a spontaneous activity in your visual cortex, and that visual cortex, a spontaneous activity, will strongly impact how you perceive me. Let's say if you had if I look similar to your father, and you have a really bad relationship with your father, you will perceive me in a different way than if you had a different one. Yeah, because psychodynamically you call this projection. So that doesn't work, but it's neither fully active either. Yeah, that would be a Kantian model of mind, absolute spontaneity, and also applied then to the brain. So meaning this traditional philosophical distinction, which also is quite present in current neuroscience between sensory and cognitive activity, doesn't really apply to the brain. So it doesn't work either. And that's why I like to speak of a spectrum model of the brain. There's a continuum between pure spontaneity and pure passivity or pure stimulus activity. Yeah? The stimulus activity is always confounded by the spontaneous activity. The spontaneous activity is never purely spontaneous. So that basically leads to what I called here, interaction model of brain. And that leads to a lot of research, how this works out. That's why I indicated I don't want to go into details about that. And basically the main idea is, so how can we characterize this spontaneous activity? Remember this orange line. And that's one essential feature of that is really time. And I say that that is central for mental features. So the main claim of this talk is basically the overarching hypothesis I want to put forward and sort of somewhat develop and support a little bit. These are first steps, obviously, because from your point of view, you will probably say at the end of the talk, yeah, nice and well, but it was purely descriptive. You lack models, you lack mechanisms. Right, you are so. That's why I say I need you guys. Yeah? So the main idea is really here is maybe temporospatial dynamics, and I will explain that more. Does that provide a link between neuronal and mental activity? Yeah? So what you phenomenologically experience may be traced to temporospatial patterns which make it possible for neuronal activity to transform into mental activity. And of course, there are a lot of assumptions in there and a lot of problematic assumptions the way I phrase it. So that's basically the overarching thing. Here I tell you what we currently really don't know is how neuronal activity is linked to mental activity. We just don't know. Philosophically, we said we cannot see mental features, self-consciousness in the body, so we need to assume a mind. That goes back to Descartes, obviously. And interestingly, that has been somewhat also transposed into current neuroscience, where people say we have specific neuronal correlates of consciousness, and that's distinct from all the other neuronal mechanisms of the brain. So you implicitly have somewhat of a neuronal dualism. So here, the approach is somewhat different, that we say maybe certain patterns, certain predispositions in the neuronal activity itself, maybe I need to do the Canadian hockey thing now, to transform into mental features. So what is their common currency? In order for A to transform into B, something must be similar, because otherwise the transformation would not be possible. Yeah? So, and that, what is this similar feature between A and B slash the common currency? That's what we call it. And I would argue this is time-space dynamics, and that if that is in a certain dynamical patterns yet to be determined, then neuronal activity can transform into experience of mental activity. So I use here the notion of transformation, and I will try to provide a little bit more flesh to the bones to that later, but this is probably one of the areas where I could also imagine where I could learn a lot from you make some kind of models for them. So, plan and outline of talks, this is the main hypothesis, temporal spatial dynamics as a common currency, as a bridge, link between neuronal and mental features. First, I want to go a little bit into the background, more the philosophical background, a very short ontology of time. Then I want to present some actual data, called temporal neuroscience. And at the end, if there's interest for that, I want to give some of, again, the philosophical implications for one of the major problem, the mind-body problem, which I assume, if you have such a view in the upper part, also changes. So, and if you want to ask questions in between, feel free to do so. I think it's better for the discussion. Yeah, so it's, don't worry. And because I think what I notice, I think there's a lot of convergences in our discussion. But what is really important, that sometimes even if we use the same concepts, we may use them in different meanings. So there's a lot of translation work to be done. And that translation work, from my point of view, can be extremely fruitful. But then you really have to go into details, even if it's embarrassing. So I, of course, when you ask me certain questions, I cannot answer because I don't have the physics background. Yeah, but you, that is very important, my feeling is that, because that's where really the, we do this a lot, and my group has people from all kinds of disciplines, and we just, sometimes we just end up in conceptual discussions, what does this mean, what does that mean? Yeah, but then you get new ideas and how to link them. So it's very important. So I start, and I also must be thankful. For me, it was a very, when putting this talk together, it was a very nice thing that I could put basically all my three fields together and link them in the hope that you would understand. Because usually, if you have specialist audiences, you can't do that. Good. First part, time. And here I already make a strong, strong statement. I have a certain view of time, a dynamic view of time, and I flesh it out here as a relational ontology of time, and it's probably not that far from what you call temporal naturalism. I'm sure, so I read that paper, and I think there's a lot of convergences. Yeah. So, very briefly, standard view, and I speak here more sort of how neuroscientists often conceive time. This is sort of more, of course, the implicit presupposition. When you ask a neuroscientist, how do you conceive time? You would say, what a stupid question. Yeah, but it's sort of more the implicit presuppositions about your conceptions, your models, which ultimately drive your data acquisition. Yeah, and I'm sure you know this very well from your point of view. So the clinician view is really that the time is a container for world and brain, and that philosophically, of course, goes strong with the Bloch view of time and brain, of time. And what is important for the neuroscientist, time is just the way the brain perceives time. Yeah, so it's not that the neuroscientist often would think about the dynamics of time by itself, independent of our perception and cognition, but they're usually related to how you perceive and cognize time. So often, in terms of discrete points in time and space, which you can isolate. Yeah, so for them, when they say, I had this many times in reviews, that they say, your temporal approach is trivial because, of course, we perceive cognitive time. Yeah. And that's basically the way, time provides a container, and the brain is just for perceiving and cognizing. However, you have an alternative view in philosophy, the dynamic view, which is often associated with presentism in the metaphysics of time and philosophy. Time, there's an active construction of time, and this is a continuous process. Yeah, so there's continuous change, there's continuous process, there's a continuous dynamics. And that's the way that's the kind of concept of time I presuppose for my whole talk. And there are various reasons for why I'm doing that, philosophical and also psychiatric and neuroscientist reason. Some of that will come out, can also be questions. So you see here also the notions of inner and outer time space. I come back to that because it goes back to Kant. So what is important here is really that time is conceived as a relation, and that also implies the brain constructs its own time, its spontaneous activity, but that time is also continuously related to the time of the world. And I will try to provide more support for that. Why spatial-temporal dynamics? So first question, so now I basically try to get a little bit into the view why I consider the time-space dynamics so central for the brain and its mental features. Yeah? My main starting point is really where do mental features or where do subjectivity come from? And it took me many, many, many years and many dead ends. And I say, okay, why? Because first, they must be shared by world and brain, and mental features, and you will see this, I consider mental features not to be located in the brain or consciousness, but they establish a relation between you and the world. So you become, in a metaphorical sense, by means of your consciousness, you become part of the world in a perspectival relation. I will come back to that particular when I bring examples from psychiatry.
I just had a question about the inner and outer time on the previous slide, which said we're continuously linked.
Yeah.
So would this account, for instance, for falling asleep or dreams, where you might not have this kind of continuous relation between inner and outer time and mental?
Yeah. Good question. Let me get to the next or the next slide, and I come back to that. I skipped that for a reason. You will see. I come back to that. Yeah. And you will see, here's a nice quote by Nikola Tesla. Read up his biography, he's a very interesting guy. here's basically the say, as a philosopher, as an ontologist, I say temporal spatial dynamics is universal in the world. And then, of course, I raise the question, if that is so, it must be manifest also in the world. So that's sort of more philosophical viewpoint. So here and now I come back to Kant. So the distinction between inner and outer time goes back to Kant. And of course, I'm a German philosopher, so of course I was strongly trained, and one of the stepping stones philosophically is Kant, and the other one you will see in the next slide. And he used of inner outer time, and note that I use this distinction in a relative way. Why? Because ultimately, and now I'm coming to your question, it's a continuum between inner and outer. Yeah, so your brain sort of is a continuous balance between internal and external mental contents. On that continuum, you can be shifted more towards the internal pole, like in dreams, but you still have the structure of your experience is still there. That's why you have experience or consciousness. But the contents are more internal. Yeah, that's what your dreams are. Yeah, but you have then other conditions where it's more oriented towards the world. For instance, when you take psychedelic drugs, you feel in unity with the world. Yeah. And that is possibly mediated by an internal-external continuum, which the brain sort of mediates. Yeah. And this continuum is probably constituted by certain time scales and features. Yeah. For instance, when you have internal contents, you operate on a slower time scale. When you have more externally oriented, you're much faster. So your brain switches to faster frequencies. Yeah? I will come back to that. So note that the distinction inner-outer time is a relative one. Yeah? relative to the world, the brain produces inner time. Yeah, but it's not an absolute one, because I had that argument that people thought that. Yeah, so it's really, and that what is important here, that probably, and I will show examples for that later, that the brain constructs its own inner time relative to the time of the outer time of the world. So that's why we included these arrows, yeah, these black arrows, yeah. So that's very important, basically, and you will, I make that point stronger, that the brain's time is contained or nested within the ongoing change of the world's time. Yeah, it's an important issue. Yeah, okay. So more time, yet another historical, and of course, as you might now ask me as a physicist, how do you bring the time of consciousness, the time of the brain, and the psychological time together with the physical time? There's a wonderful book which came out recently about the encounter between Henri Bergson and Einstein in 1923, where they discussed about time. And Einstein, of course, you know this much better than I do, put forward his view that there's only physical time, the Bloch view of time, and Bergson was arguing against that. There's a distinction between psychological and physical time. And the question is, of course, how do you link these different notions of time? Yeah, and I think, as far as I see, that is still yet unresolved issue. So, for that, I somewhat turn, because of course I'm confronted with that too, yeah, as a neuroscientist and psychiatrist. So with that, Leibniz distinguished between different levels of time. Some authors interpret there are three levels of time in Leibniz, others say there's only two. Here I just point out the real and the ideal time. What is important, there's real time, and then there's the ideal time. The ideal time is an abstraction from the real time. So, and we developed this, it's very interesting, these different notions of time, sort of interestingly resurface also in Chinese philosophy. There's an ancient Chinese philosopher, Zhang Zhi, very clever guy, it's unbelievable. It's beautiful philosophy. And we worked with a colleague in Taiwan, we worked this and this came out recently, that we distinguished different levels of time in Leibniz as well as in Zhang Zhi, yeah? And so here we speak of world-based time, so that's probably the time you address in physics. Then there's also brain-based time. That's the time I'm interested in, experience-based time. And then also the time we perceive or we cognize in our cognition. So then, of course, the question is, how are these different levels of time related? And that's really reminiscent of that old question. So, how is that related? And that's, we discussed this a lot, that's why I would argue that maybe scale-free properties, scale-freeness is the central issue. So there's a certain temporal nestedness. So the range of the world-based time is obviously much larger than the brain. Each has its own, now I quote Bergson, its own inner duration. Then you have your experience-based time and maybe the cognition. And what is important, that these are abstractions from each other. Yeah? So this is, of course, the brain ontologically is part of the world. So the brain, the world's time is basically constructed within and through the brain. So the distinction between different times is probably just an abstraction, is the only way we can do it. So that's why I assume here a continuum, philosophically that's important, from the ontology to the epistemology. So from levels, different levels of abstraction. And as you can see, I try to indicate that they really nestedness in each other. What do I mean by temporal nestedness? Let me skip that one. That's a typical example of nestedness. Russian dolls, same shape, similar size, different sizes. And you have the same in the Chinese, you have these beautiful crystal balls in China, yeah? So that's a typical nested, that's spatial nestedness, and I assume the same on the temporal. So now you can raise the question, so how is it possible? What unifies these different examples? The crystal ball, the Chinese crystal balls, the Russian dolls, and the nestedness, the temple nest. Different spatial sizes, small to large, different temple durations, short to long. Self-similarity in shape, form, or structure. Same shape across the different sizes. Temple, same fluctuation in different time intervals, fluctuations. Of course, that's a very loose definition of scale-free properties, so don't, you know this much better than I do, so don't nail me down here. And that's a crucial thing. So here, ontologically, I would assume that there's a temple nestedness of these different levels of time. Now the question arises, how are these different levels of time transformed into each other? Yeah? So that raises really the question of transformation. And for that, we work together with mathematicians in Japan. You can see here. And we apply the category theory because natural transformation is a central issue in category theory. Yeah? And this is, I could imagine, I think the notion of transformation is absolutely central for me. Because what I need to show is how neuronal activity, the space-time pattern of neuronal activity, transforms into mental activity. And your consciousness is space-time. You have a certain speed, experience of speed of consciousness. After this lecture, when you said, oh my gosh, this was horribly boring. And you thought, oh my gosh, this guy spoke 2 hours, but it was only 1 hour. Yeah? So where does this perception of the additional hour come from? Yeah? That's added by your brain. Yeah? So meaning that your consciousness, and I will show this later with examples from psychiatric patients, is intrinsically temple. It has a temple basis. William James, famous psychologist, spoke of a stream of consciousness. Yeah? Henri Bergson, philosopher, beginning of 20th century, again, consciousness, inner duration. Yeah? Very, very important. And I will, as I said, I will bring more examples of that. So the question is really, I think, from a physical or biological view, what is this transformation? So this is one way where we try to approach this. Please don't pin me down for the mathematical details. You can connect to my colleagues there. So in the issue of natural transformation, and we now also try to apply this to frequency space and bring this together with data and modeling. Yeah? So that's one of the ways here, some of the detail, and it's really a crucial issue. So what you see here, transformation and the other notion is scale-free property. So this is basically just a philosophy, and I say that time is dynamic that can be characterized by temporal nestedness and by continuous transformation between different timescales. So now, I hope so, I'm at the point where I can say, now I can step to the data. Yeah, so now I can try, maybe I can try to investigate scale-free properties in the brain and how they are related to mental features. So that's now my next part. Now I show you some example of how scale-freeness in the brain is related to mental features. Yeah? And that's the basic idea is here. You hear a lot about, So you hear a lot about this one. You hear in the media, they found racism has related to this brain area or whatever. Yeah, that's what you see in the Guardian News, in the New York Times, and that's what you make the headline. However, none of that explains why do you have a certain experience, a feeling, a consciousness, and why is that related to yourself? So that is really about brain function. Remember, that was the first model of the brain, yeah, the purely mechanical model. And that is not wrong, but it just probably describes one aspect, and that must be embedded in a larger framework. That's probably the brain dynamics. Yeah, and that's where I didn't put this into this figure here. That's probably where mental features like sense of self, yeah, or consciousness, free will, emotional feeling comes up with. So what we are currently doing, and I will provide more support for that, that we try to associate different mental features with different kinds of spatial temporal patterns. Yeah? And that's where, of course, I need to know how to analyze these space-time dynamics. You will see some examples of that. And that's another convergence point from my side to you. That's where I would say maybe you have better tools and better ideas and better mechanisms and models for this brain dynamics. I think this one only works this way. Yeah? Good. So just to tell you a little bit the kind of data we're dealing with, here obviously this is a brain, this is for instance from fMRI, certain regions light up, certain regions don't, and then this is a time series, typical time series, and we get similar time series in fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, these data where you have the colorful dots and spots, then EEG, electroencephalography, measures local field potentials. And what you also measure, that's the time series, that's basically the raw data, and then you do various kinds of pre-processing in order to get the artifact out, and so on and so on. There's a lot of story to that. And what is important, then you can do, for instance, the fast Fourier or Hilbert transformation, and then you get different frequencies. Okay, I knew that would happen. So you get different frequencies out of this, and I just show you basically the frequency range in which we operate. It doesn't need to be the frequency range of the brain as such, because of course we are limited by the instruments with which we measure the brain. And I indicate that here. So here in the very slow frequency range, 0.01 hertz or 0.001 hertz, we speak of infraslow, we call this infraslow. And that basically goes to 1 hertz. Then 1 to 4 hertz we call delta, 5 to 8 hertz we call theta. Theta is often associated with memory, it's been quite well known. Alpha is between 8 and 13 hertz. That's basically like a gate. Your brain is like the gate of the brain. In order to for external events to be processed by the brain, you need to open that gate, meaning lower your alpha. Beta is between 13 and 30 hertz. It's mainly associated with sensory-motor functions. And gamma is faster with perception. And you see I sort of showed the kind of function associated with these different frequencies. And you also notice that I completely left out the function associated here with the slower stuff. These frequencies have been very well researched, because they're the most easily accessible in EEG. And you see there are all kinds of cognitive function associated. The slower ones sort of have a bad reputation because they increase when you lose consciousness. I show this later. When you lose consciousness, when you become sleepy, or when you're anesthetic, that's when you have a much more power in these slow frequencies. So that's why they're sort of bad reputation. And often people didn't really also invest. The fMRI is relatively young, just since 20 years. So, and that's basically we're operating. And now, of course, we try to find different kinds of measures, whether there are certain patterns in this time series. Here, I show you again. I show you three measures which we often like to apply. So here's again the time series, either from fMRI or EEG. One measure is, I don't need to tell you, this is scale-free activity. We measure that with the power law distribution, with a power law exponent, and it is clear that the slow frequencies have much more power than the faster ones. We measure that either with the power law exponent, or if we measure the scale-free, also just of the oscillations, the fluctuations oscillation is detrended fluctuation analysis, DFA. And more recently, we also distinguish in the power spectrum between fractal and oscillatory properties. Because we assume that maybe these two properties are associated with different, have a different role in mental features. So that's exactly, the results seem to be very encouraging. But that's completely new. I cannot show any data on that yet. Another function, I'm sure you know, this is an autocorrelation function, autocorrelation window, the time lags and the coefficient of correlation across time points. Other measures which we have is entropy, multiscale entropy, Lempelsiev complexity, which we often get from physics and engineering. And here you see I'm very open to new measures and models from your side, because I assume that each measure measures something slightly different, and that captures a different aspect of neuronal activity of the pattern, and then probably also of mental features.
Is this in people that's being shown here?
This is real data, yeah.
Animals,
applies to.
It's parallel.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Yeah, the power law is also on the psychological level interesting. When you have the psychological time series, let's say, of reaction times, the fluctuations in your reaction time follow a scale-free distribution. Yeah, it is really so that makes this. This is one of the reasons. I mean, when I started all this 3-4 years ago with the scale-free activity, I had no idea. I just tried. Yeah, and you will see some of the results. It's really encouraging. Yeah. So now I show you some actual application of the data. In the first application, we did a lot of research on your sense of self. I don't want to go into the philosophy of self, whatever it is. But just, you see yourself in the morning in the mirror, and I hope that everybody recognizes, it's me. Huh? And that's not only just recognition. You also have a sense, a feeling, a certain experience. Yeah. And that is very important, because as a psychiatrist, I know very well that there are conditions where you don't recognize yourself in the mirror anymore. Yeah? Where you have the feeling, no, this is somebody else. Yeah? And that goes with the feeling, an experience of estrangement and extreme insecurity. And these people are no longer, often schizophrenia, no longer able to navigate in the world, because they really lost their sense of self. Yeah? It's a very tragic but also very telling example. Yeah, and interestingly, just on a side note, many of these people take on a new form of self, and often a very famous self. And that again is culturally dependent. So in the Western world, I saw a lot of, when I was working back in Germany and also here in Canada now, I saw a lot of Jesuses. Yeah, I remember one of my first patients as a resident, I wanted to interview him, and I came, yes, I would like to talk to you. And he was lying on the bed and nothing. And then I asked him several times, and suddenly he rose up and said, "How do you dare to talk to me? I'm Jesus." And then he knocked me down. Yeah? And he also looked like Jesus, with a beard, with a white coat. Yeah? So it was complete, and he felt it like this. Yeah? So I learned my lesson. Yeah? But interestingly, when you go to the eastern part of the world, you see suddenly some Buddhas. Actually, in Germany, I saw a Nofretete, and in China, I saw several Maos. Yeah? So that is really, it's very interesting. Yeah, and they really live it. Yeah, it's not just, okay, now here I'm Jesus now, but it's really with their complete feeling, experience, this is their self is now Jesus. Actually, in one instance I had in a ward, I had two Jesuses, same unit. And then I asked one of them, I said, yeah, and they both were very intelligent. They were both students. Yeah. So I said, yeah, do you know about Jesus? Yes. Do you know the history of Jesus? Yes. And then I said, how many Jesus are there? Of course, only one. It's only me. And I said, yeah, but is it possible if another person claims she or he is Jesus? What do you think? Yeah, she must be wrong. Yeah. And the other one said exactly the same. Yeah. So the cognition is still preserved, the logic. Yeah. But the experience. Yeah. And this certainty, they're absolutely certain. That's what makes it, yeah? I can also claim Jesus, but I'm still doubtful, yeah? But they're absolutely certain, yeah? And that's your subjective experiential component. Yeah? So what we did here, and that was a study 2016 which we did, a postdoc from China. So we investigated the pure resting state activity in the brain. So subjects lied in the scanner for 10 minutes, didn't do anything, eyes closed, and nothing, no own name, nothing. So nothing of which reminded their own name. And we did this in fMRI, and first we looked here in specific regions in the brain which have been associated with the self, particular regions in the middle of the brain. we call them cortical midline structures. This is the medial prefrontal cortex, posterior cingulate cortex. Forget, it's not that important for you. But what you see here is a typical power spectra. You see the frequency range of fMRI, 0.01 Hz to 0.1. You see the power here. And you see each line is one subject. Typically, you're not surprised, of course. You see more power in the slower frequencies than in the faster. You see the typical curve. And each line is one subject. And that's where it starts, where I, as a neuroscientist, say, wow, look at the inter-individual difference in the curves. Yeah? This guy has much a slower frequency than this one. Yeah? So, and this is not noise. This is not artifact. So for you, it might be banal. For a neuroscientist who's usually used to average across subjects, this is very important. So there's inter-individual difference. They are intrinsic. It's not just extrinsic noise. Yeah? Measurement-related noise, we would say. So it's an intrinsic feature. And also you see between the two regions slightly different power spectra in the shape. So then, and this is just the resting state. Then we had also a psychological instrument, a scale for analyzing these people's self-consciousness. So of course you have a question, do I have a lot of, am I often mentally absent? Do I often have inner thoughts? Do I think about myself or do I think about others? Of course, it's a questionnaire. It's empirically very bad, but this is the first approximation how you can do this. So, and this questionnaire, the self-consciousness scale, has three different dimensions. There's a private dimension, mainly the private self, the inner self, the public, and the social. And interestingly, it was only the private dimension which really directly correlated with your scale-free activity. Meaning, the more power you had in your slow frequency, meaning the higher your power law exponent, the steeper the curve, the higher your degree of self-consciousness. So that sort of was one of the first studies where we saw, wow, there really seems to be a direct relationship between mental features. Of course, it's a purely correlation, the descriptive results, I'm aware of all the weaknesses, but nevertheless, it's a start. You have to start somewhere. So we say, wow, maybe these mental features, scale-free activity, and this is resting state. There's no name, nothing presented. It's just pure resting state. So first, that your self-consciousness was associated with scale-free activity. And second, this is pure resting state. Maybe already in your resting state, there's some information about your sense of self encoded. So then we try to do the same in EEG. So EEG is a faster frequency range. You see 1 to 70. See whether I wanted to see it also hold it there. And that exactly was the case. So here you see now the EEG. This is, remember, this is this gate, this alpha range. And again, we saw again here in those subjects, the higher your power law exponent in these faster frequencies, the higher your degree of self-consciousness. So, and then we also included in this EEG study also other measures like the autocorrelation window and cross-frequency coupling, and again, both correlated with your degree of self-consciousness. So that was sort of one line of findings where we said, wow, maybe your sense of self, yeah?
About the data, is this all healthy subjects or there are also Jesuses and Maos?
No, these are all healthy subjects. All health, what you call health. I hope none of the subjects is in the room, yeah?
No. So it's not, there is no clear outline.
Yeah, good question. So we are currently working on schizophrenia. And there we have a much better scale. For in schizophrenia, you assume what they call a basic self-disturbance, yeah? And that causes all your different symptoms like delusions, hallucinations. There's a group in Denmark which developed a very nice scale for the subjective experience of an altered self in schizophrenia. It's a very complex interview. And those guys also got EEG. And interestingly, their power law exponent was flatter, meaning lower, and it correlated with their degree of self-disturbance. So we're just about putting this together. So you can imagine I was very happy seeing that because it really provides a transition. Yeah? Because you need to account for the extreme states with the same measures, but in different degrees. Yeah? So that's sort of, we try to build our case here. It's a very good question.
Which way is the causation? So for example, if you externally change that spectrum to make it flatter or to make it less flat, would it change, would the symptoms of schizophrenia change, or is it just the other way around?
Okay. So I give you the number of the ethics commission, you call them, and then I do this job. Okay? Yeah, but that's exactly what you would like to do. Yeah? You would like to, let's say, cut off some of the power spectrum. You would like to change the shape of the power spectrum, how that impacts your sense of self. Because that's what I need. These are all correlational data. This is shitty. Yeah? You want some kind of causality. So that is one way you can do modeling, which I would love to do. But I cannot do this because I don't have that expertise. Yeah. Plug in some real data, then change, let's say, the shape of your power spectrum and see how that affects your sense of self, however you want to measure it in your model. And the other way is pathological disorders, yeah, like disorders like schizophrenia. And the other way is stimulation. So you can do transcranial magnetic stimulation, see how your power spectrum changes. And this is one way we're currently going. Yeah, and the modeling I would love to do, but that's probably where I would need collaboration for that. Yeah, particular for something like that. The problem is, and we're working on that, that even here, maybe this shape, this power spectrum might be entertained by two or three different components, which is not fully clear yet. So the original theme that here in EEG, for each of these different frequencies, you have one oscillator. Whether that really holds, it's great, but for the infraslow, that doesn't work, that you just have a single oscillator, yeah? Because they're also not spatially localized. So it's a major issue, because I assume that the shape of your power spectrum, and we touched upon that this morning, is vitally important. It's a predisposition whether you can have mental features or not. It's your temporal organization, yeah? But that's very intuitively and speculatively. Yeah? But that's where we really need to work together with the computational people. Yeah, that's very clear. But that's, you really go into the basics of the brain, the basic building blocks of the brain. And that's a thing, that's where we need to go. So many of my colleagues, they go to cognition and say, okay, specific forms of attention and working memory. I rather look down and say, what are the basic building blocks? And this is one of them. Sorry. Yeah.
How many individuals do you have there in those?
Oh, these were, I think these were about 40, 50 subjects. Yeah?
And they are randomly selected?
These were just, yeah, randomly selected. Yeah? So these were just here, the blue and the red is low and high. Just
that's the same number of lines that on the left. Right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, and, yeah. So that's basically here. Now, remember, I had this idea of the common currency. This is more a conceptual part. So we have these different measures here, power law exponent, autocorrelation window, modulation index is a cross-frequency coupling. And each describes the different temporal features, like here nestedness, ACW, autocorrelation window, temporal continuity, or cross-frequency coupling, temporal integration. And then we assume that analogous temporal features are manifest on the mental level. So now, of course, you say, yeah, please provide evidence that these guys here in the middle, yeah, okay, yeah, that these guys in the middle are not only manifest here, but also manifest here. So meaning you would like to have a mental time series. And then you can analyze that with the same measures as here. And that's not so easy to get, as you can imagine, but we are trying to make that case. And then if you have a correlation between, let's say, this power law exponent and this power law exponent on the mental side, that would provide support for that idea that that is really a bridge or link. Yeah? So that's one of the ways we are currently going. So I always like to show this. Italy is one of my favorite countries in the world. And obviously Leonardo da Vinci, this is the Last Supper from Milano. So when you look at the Da Vinci's paintings, sorry for the Freudian lapsus here, you see it's unbelievable you have the feeling that the painting is alive. The people are alive. There's always rivers in the background. You have the feeling that the water is flowing towards you. Yeah? So he creates a 3D dynamics out of a static 2D structure on the canvas. Yeah? And you see here, look how he does this. Unbelievable when you look at his painting. And that, I think, exactly what also your brain does. It's a virtual 3D structure which you cannot observe from the outside. Yeah? And that's what he does here, this transformation from 2D to 3D. Yeah? And that's something I think is in part what for us from the outside observer the brain seems to do when it creates these mental features. Yeah? So that's why I like this comparison, and you can judge whether that comparison holds or limps. Yeah? Good. Yet another example is consciousness. So whatever consciousness is, I don't want to go into this all these various definitions. I say consciousness for me is a very basic experience. One central feature of consciousness is that it is perspectival. It puts you into a perspectival relationship relative to the rest of the world. You have, we touched upon this morning, and you still owe me the physical explanation, the point of view. Yeah? Thomas Nagel, which is often cited, What Is It Like to Be a Bat, 1974, the paper, very famous in philosophy of mind, he described that the bat has a different point of view than us. And I would agree with that. Why? Because the bat has a different spatial-temporal range and repertoire than us. So it relates to the world in a different perspectival way than us. And here you already see that I imply that the bat might have consciousness. But maybe a different range with different spatial-temporal dynamical features. Yeah? For instance, the bat can venture into the ultrasonar wave, a range which we can't. Yeah? So that's this point of view. I don't go into that because it's too complicated and I have no solution for that. But that's a central issue for me. So here, how can you tackle this empirically? One way is to go indirect through the loss of consciousness. And I show you again here a study which we published last year. One of my Chinese students who is in Hangzhou in China, investigated that in anesthesia. And he had some very clever ways of analyzing the data, and I show you here. So here, the more red, of course, the more activity. This is pure resting state. You can see this up here. This is the same subject in the anesthetic state, and you see it's basically no activity, and that is the difference, it's a huge activity throughout the whole brain. Then we analyze the power spectra in those guys. Yeah, in the awake and in the anesthetic state. And you can see here, this is the typical power spectrum. This is fMRI in the awake state. You see strong power in the slow frequency, and then here. And the typical shape of the curve. I don't need to tell you a typical scale. Now, look at this one. This is a curve in the anesthetic state. The whole shape of the curve broke down. Yeah? So there's no scale freeness. Yeah? So the structure, the temporal structure of the power spectrum got completely lost. So this is sort of one interesting case for what you asked that question. Yeah? When you have, interestingly, and I don't show that here because I forgot to put in those slides, when you have sedated states, then you have a different power spectrum. Then you have shift towards a slower frequency power. You have a power spectrum like this. Yeah? So the basic shape is still there in the sedated state, but it's shifted. Yeah? Here it's completely broken down. Yeah? So the basic structure of the power spectrum is still preserved in the sedated state, meaning you still have the capacity to become conscious. Here, you don't. Your structure's done. This is what I call here is a neural predisposition of consciousness, a necessary condition of possible consciousness broken down. Yeah? And then, this is not easy. So he investigated two measures. He investigated the power law exponent and the neuronal variability. So the root mean square of the amplitude of the signal. And he wanted to know which of these two measures is central for consciousness. Because he observed in both a huge reduction, I told you the PLE hugely decreased, and in the neuronal variability standard deviation, he also observed a huge reduction in the anesthetic state. So from that, you would say, look, both seem to be relevant for the loss of consciousness. However, then we came up with a very good idea of analyzing the data. So we did some intersubjective correlation. So we basically correlated the different subjects with each other and looked how similar they are. You assume that, let's say we did this in the awake state. Of course, you assume that the structure of our power law exponent is somewhat similar between all people us in this room. Yeah, because I think there's good reason to assume that everybody in this room is conscious. If not, please let me know. So you have a high intersubject correlation. And we did this for the different regions of the brain. So we measured the PLE in each region, and then all the different PLEs in your different regions correlated with my different regions PLE. Yeah? And you see a quite high correlation here for the PLE awake. Then we did, you see the same for the standard deviation awake, standard here. But you see already the correlation is slightly lower. And then here in the anesthetic set, maybe it's the best one you read, this one here, that's a spatial pattern, so that we, in the anesthetic state, here you don't see the correlation of the PLE awake with the PLE anesthetic. Whereas when you look for the same, you see the SD awake still correlates with the SD anesthetic. So the spatial pattern of the SD, albeit lower, the absolute values, was still preserved in the neuronal variability. But it was not preserved in the anesthesia. So that's why the spatial pattern, so even if your SD is lower, you in the anesthetic state, me in the awake state, still have the same spatial pattern, relative pattern of SD distribution across regions. Whereas in the power law exponent, that wasn't the case. So we tentatively infer from this that it's the temporal structure as well as the spatial structure, which really broke down here in anesthesia. And that's a particular the scale freeness is important, not the neuronal variability. Yeah? So that gives you an idea. And when I saw this data, I was really elated because it really makes a point. It's the structure, the organization of your time dynamics, which is important. Yeah, it's not the absolute values. Yeah. So based on these and many other findings, we developed a temporal spatial theory of consciousness. You have to know that in neuroscience, there's an abundance of theories of consciousness because nobody knows. So we really say where we distinguish between different temporal spatial mechanisms. Now we come back to that. And we call this the temporal spatial theory of consciousness. And one of the things which I would really like to do, I would link it much more strongly to physics. So this is, I think, one of the convergences which I would really like to do, because I do think that any theory of the brain, let alone any theory of consciousness, must be rooted in physics. There's no way. Yeah? Otherwise, you leave something out. So I think this is here what I just called with the scale-free activity, the findings. We assume the temporal spatial nestedness. Then we assume a second mechanism, which we call temporal spatial alignment. And I show you in the following how that might work. When you hear a piece of music which you like, you might unconsciously tap to the rhythm of the music, or you do this. And you're not aware of this. You just do this completely automatic, meaning you align the rhythm of your brain to the rhythm of the music. Alignment, or we call it also entrainment. And this is basically what I distinguished here, that you align to the stimulus, and basically the brain's neuronal activity and its phase onset, as I showed here, align to the onset of the tone. And here another thing, and ultimately you align your neuronal stimuli, your neuronal activity to the onset of the environmental stimuli. So currently what we are doing now, we are investigating the temporal structure of music and movies and quantify that with power law exponent, autocorrelation window, entropy, and other measures, and then measure and do the same measures in the brain. And we assume that the more similar, let's say, the scale-free activity in music and brain is, the more that person will like the music. Yeah? So that's what we call alignment, which might be central for your experience of that stimulus. So, and I need to say, conceptual, so I think I should have done that earlier, but it's clear, the intrinsic durations in the brain related to the durations in the world. So that's what we call here is mechanism, and that's what the kind of experiments what I just currently doing. On a conceptual level, this is, on a more conceptual level, because it provides a bridge to the philosophical part, to the last part. It's really that I speak of a world-brain relation because your brain adapts to the world. So, and that's why we wrote different papers on this and blah, 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 blah. So, one last interesting empirical example from psychiatry. We have bipolar patients. Bipolar patients suffer either from mania, they're too happy, or from depression, it's clear, too much depression. So, and what you have in manic and depressed people, that depressed people usually, depressed people experience time as too slow. I think I already told you about the example of the young Chinese girl with a mother. And whereas manic people, for them, things are too fast. So we investigate this. So what you can say that depressed people, their inner time speed is too slow. Nothing changes for them. They sit there and you can ask them. They often report that to you. Nothing changes. Time is an eternity. Time does not flow. 1 hour lasts for them like 2 weeks, yeah? And of course, when you have that feeling, you get depressed. Manic people, and for the depressed people, what happens outside is always too fast. So of course, relatively to the inner time, even if it's normal time, it's too fast. And in manic people, it's exactly the opposite. The inner time is way too fast, and we are too slow. So what happens when you have the feeling that the other is too slow? You get impatient, angry, and aggressive. Yeah, be faster. That's exactly what happens to these guys. So that's basically what I want to say here. This slide is important, that we say that your speed of outer time, how you subjectively perceive the time in the outer world, you perceive this relative to your inner time, because you take your inner time as a reference. Yeah? That's your default. That's your reference, that's your standard, against which you set the perceived outer time. So it's all relative in that sense. Yeah? If your speed of inner time is too fast, you experience the outer time as too slow. And if your inner time is too slow, you experience the outer time as too fast, even if objectively the outer time is the same. So then we said, okay, how can we model speed on the neuronal level? So we investigated neuronal variability, the degree of change, in a dynamic way with sliding windows. And we know that sort of inner time perception has something to do with the sensory-motor network, SMN. Outer time perception, we took the visual network as a proxy. And what we observed is that indeed, so then we investigated the ratio between the variability in these networks as proxies of inner and outer time. And we showed exactly that on the neuronal level, the time speed relations between inner and outer time speed neuronal were exactly mirroring what you experienced on the phenomenological level. So here we did the ratio. So here you could see the manic patients, they are too fast, so they had a strong variability, meaning a lot of change in the neuronal activity in the inner time network, sensory motor network. So that goes along with the perception of increased time speed, versus in visual network, it was the other way. Here's the most impressive other depression. Depressed people are extremely slow, psychomotor, nothing happens. The inner time perception, as said, is too slow, so they have not enough time speed neuronally in this network. So their neuronal variability value was extremely low. Visual network, outer time experience as too fast, too much neuronal variability. So that then ultimately comes down that in the healthy subject, and you could see that here the values in the healthy subject are relatively balanced between the two networks. You have somewhat a balance between inner and outer time speed neuronally, whereas in mania, this is in depression, and in mania, it's exactly disbalanced thoughts extreme. So that gives you some, it was a first try, how we link time-speed perception on the neuron, on the phenomenal level or mental level to the time-speed of the neuronal level. So same measures, time-speed on both phenomenal and neuronal level. So here's another example, scale-free activity in autism. You know that autistic patients have too much social withdrawal and they're completely focused on their own self. And what we interestingly could find that they have too much slow frequency power and increased scale-free activity, which was quite a consistent finding, could also be replicated. So all aligns to that, more on the conceptual phenomenological level, that consciousness is not in the head. Consciousness is between you and the world. And the degree to which you align and part of the world. Remember the inner-outer time-speed perception, that you perceive the outer time relative to your inner time. So that's the relation. Yeah, that's what we call, like to call, spatial-temporal alignment. So briefly, I'd probably speed that up a little bit because I'm already talking way too long. The third part, the implications, I make that very short because I'm also... So one major problem in philosophy is, of course, the mind-body problem goes back to Descartes. And and it's still really unresolved. All kinds of hypotheses have been, not even theories, hypotheses, not theories have been put forward. And I would argue, forget it. We don't need the mind. We can replace this by what I call world brain problem, and this gets a little bit into the adventurous side. So I briefly go there to remember this one, and ultimately the relation between brain and world, also ontologically, is characterized by temporal nestedness. On the other hand, I showed you various lines of data that the scale freeness here, temporal nestedness, predicts mental features. So there's empirical support for the idea that temporal nestedness is related to mental features. So now ontologically, I would argue that maybe the world brain relation, temporal nestedness, is a necessary condition of mental features. So that's exactly the point I want to make. And conceptually, what is very important, I like to distinguish between what I call world brain relation, because your brain actively adapts to the world. Remember the example of music? And that's really temporal spatial nestedness, directedness, and that's really ontological because the brain becomes part of the world. Yeah, and that we need to distinguish from the brain-world relation where the brain imposes itself upon the world. Here we align ourselves to the world, here we impose ourselves. Of course, there's a continuum between the two, but philosophically it's extremely important that this is more ontological and this is more epistemological. I think this is crucial. And I think in the current philosophy of mind, you often see everything is brain world. So even when you look at the back cover of my MIT book, The Spontaneous Brain, where I discuss all that and develop this world brain problem, one of the commentators describes brain world, writes brain world continuum. Yeah? So that's a very neurocentric view. Yeah? Well, brain relation, I don't want to, it's a relation-based ontology, I don't want to go into that. Ask more for that. Yeah, one important point is here is really we need a necessary, there seems to be no necessary connection between brain and consciousness. Yeah, I call this a contingency problem. And that's for me really the core problem of the mind-body problem. Thomas Nagel pointed that out very nicely in that quote. So what usually we assume, there's a necessary connection between mind and consciousness. Mind entails consciousness. And if you deny the mind, people assume that you deny consciousness. However, that presupposes a certain kind of ontology, a property-based ontology. If you assume a relation-based ontology, you can focus on the word brain relation. And that, for me, temporal spatial nestedness is a necessary connection, necessary a posteriori in the terms of Kripke. As I said, if you're not interested, just forget it. And that, in turn, that necessary connection also makes possible entails the connection between brain and consciousness. So that's, you see where time-space dynamics, it's for me not only empirically, but it's also ontological. Yeah? And it helps you to reformulate and revise the problem. So in my conception, I don't need the concept of mind. I don't even need to deny it. It's just nonsensical because I have the necessary connection from here to here. I can bring down mental features like consciousness to, in a necessary a posteriori way, and I lead that. It's a long argument, chapter 10 in the book, and it cost me a lot of time and nerves to show that. Yeah? And then you have basically two options. You have the option of the mind providing the necessary connections to consciousness and the world brain relation providing the necessary connection to consciousness. So conceptually, they're both on a par. So now you can decide which one is more empirically plausible. And that's, of course, clear what I say, world brain relation. Yeah? So then you can say, maybe we shouldn't talk about the mind-body problem, which is maybe a logically conceivable problem in the logical world, but not a sensical problem in the natural. That's where we need to talk about the world. Okay. And of course, my answer is clear. When you consider the empirical data as a support, a dynamic model of the brain, not a cognitive model, and very important for the philosopher, a relation-based rather than property-based ontology. The property-based ontology you will not get. And summary of my talk. So first, in the first part, I try to convey an ontology of time, different levels of time, this temporal nestedness of the brain within the world. Second, that temporal nestedness is central for mental features. I showed you some examples, self, consciousness, inner outer time speed in these manic and depressed patients. And last not least, that I said, no need for the mind in the natural world. You can have the relational time and the world brain problem. Thank you very much.
Any more questions for Georg?
Any? What's interesting is that you work with Chinese researchers and you're based in.
What again?
You work across different cultures. Like you did a few of your publications with Chinese researchers. Besides, like you have this work on the Chuangzi, which for me, like, it's kind of crazy, like bringing your psychology, like Chuangzi. How did you find that the cultural aspect affected your work? Like, it's kind of a general question.
What again?
How did the cultural aspect affect your work?
The virtual aspect.
Working in China, working in the West.
Ah.
Perception of time, speaking about time. Basically, the cultural elements in perception of time. Yeah.
Interesting question. Eye open. So I tell you a joke. It's a good one. So an American and a Chinese meet, and they talk about the French Revolution. And the Chinese ask the American, what do you think about the French Revolution? Old thing, not of interest. An American asks the Chinese, what do you think about it? Way too early to tell. Yeah? That tells you everything. They put things into time perspective. That's really, it's a completely different notion of time. And that affects their daily behavior. Changing now, because it becomes very Americanized now. Yeah? The other thing which is really a central issue for me is also this alignment to the world, harmony with nature. Yeah? It's a central principle there of their philosophy. Yeah? And I don't need to tell you this alignment, somewhat close to that. Yeah? So, and that's indeed central. Meditation is one instance where you try to get in harmony with your world and with yourself. Yeah? So I think it is a central feature. So for me, I often say, when you would ask me whether the brain works in the Eastern or in the Western mode, I would say Eastern. Yeah, and I'm deeply convinced about this, not only for conceptual reasons, but also for empirical reasons, what I see in psychiatry. Yeah, and this distinction between the world brain world relation is paradigmatic for that. So I have in audiences, when I give talks to Western audience, even if they want to talk about the world brain relation, they always say brain world relation. It's unbelievable. I remember I gave a talk in Sapporo in Japan, 200 people. One Western person, and he lived there for 5 years, and he spoke fluent Japanese. Unbelievable. I admire that. I don't speak a word. And then he said, he spoke of brain-world relation and was a philosopher, wanted to address this. And I asked him, why do you say brain-world? Do you do this intentionally? He said, no, I wasn't even aware of it. Yeah, and that I experienced that 100%. Whereas the Eastern people have much less problem of decentering themselves and taking this larger perspective beyond the world brain image. Yeah? So many Western philosophers would say this is a conceptual confusion, what I do, or conceptual triviality. See, I'm already preempting the arguments. It's the job of a philosopher these days.
I have two questions. So one was about this spontaneous activity. So you have this model at the start with this signal that comes in, and then the spontaneous activity to another function. They kind of interact together, which kind of, unconscious experience. But presumably we have, so the kind of spontaneous activity is like a filter, in a way you would imagine it. But presumably you have multiple different filters, so like maybe a visual filter and an emotional one. And some of these filters interact in a certain way, maybe, so that then you'd have associations between visual and like emotional things.
Yeah, good question. So you're right. In a way, it acts as a filter, but it's not just a filter. I mean, of course, you know much more about filters than I do, but it's not just a filter. It's an active manipulation of the signal. I mean, no, let me start the other way. So we have data now, which we're just about almost ready to submit, where we investigated the impact of pre-stimulus variance, so the degree of variability prior to the stimulus, how that affects the activity afterwards. And of course, with our view, we assume that there's an impact. However, the first 300 milliseconds of the stimulus, of the signal after the onset of the stimulus, was completely determined by the ongoing dynamics spilling over from pre-stimulus. And after 300 to 600 milliseconds, the stimulus had some kind of impact. So meaning, what the stimulus does is just, it's basically like a surfer. It just surfs on the ongoing waves, literally. And you see one of our 2017 paper where we did this rest-stimulus interaction. The Rui Huang, the first author, he did this wonderful comparison with surfing. And it's really true. The stimulus does not have much impact. It's just using what is there. It's like a surfer. If there are not many waves, the stimulus cannot properly surf. Yeah, that's what it is. And the surfer just slightly modifies the wave. But the direction of the wave, it's autopilot. Yeah, it's by default. And that, you have no conscious grip on that. Yeah, you have no access to that in your consciousness. This is automatic, autopilot, by default. Yeah, that's the limitation of our knowledge. We don't have access to that. Yeah, by default of the mechanism, because it's a dynamical mechanism. Yeah? So that when I saw those data, even I was surprised. I said, wow, that cannot be true. Yeah, but it is. So the stimulus is not much. So that's why you really need to investigate the dynamics and how that. And I say that because in the neuroscience, all the different tasks, different stimuli, and that region is that task and so on. That's a background against which I say that. Yeah. For you, you say, well, trivial. I didn't expect anything like that. I hope that answers your question.
Prince,
go ahead. Okay, sorry.
So between stimulus and response, is there no space that one have to make a decision on something?
Yeah. So.
And then regarding autism, is it an issue of
consciousness or a combination of brain consciousness?
Well, you formulate interesting questions. Okay, first, so that's exactly, so the traditional, remember the first model of the brain, that was a typical stimulus response model. Yeah? The stimulus is sufficient for the activity. And that's why I say no, it's not. It's at best, necessary. Yeah? It just modulates a little bit. And meaning there's a lot happening between stimulus and response. And that is the time-space dynamic, this is spontaneous activity. Yeah? And that's why I say consciousness does not come with the processing of the stimulus. Consciousness is assigned to the stimulus by your spontaneous space-time dynamics. Yeah? So you see the switch in perspective. That's very important because it entails different kind of experimental designs and different interpretations. Yeah? It's really a paradigm shift in how you use it. Your question, is it a... So of course I would never accept that. Said, is it that alternative? Is it a disorder of consciousness or disorder of brain? Of course, yeah, it's a neuroscientist. I cannot accept that formulation. It's a good question. So this was... it fits again with this idea that self, sense of self has something to do with scale-free activity. So you say, because one central line of our research is really this sense of self, because I suppose that the self is more basic than consciousness. Yeah? Philosophically, just sideline, there's a long, long debate about the relation between self and consciousness, whether consciousness requires self and so on. So there's a lot of... Yeah, so I would assume that the self is completely unconscious of it. And no doubt in these guys, they have this consciousness very much directed internally, and not externally. Yeah? And with that clinical observation, that symptom, these findings go very well along. Yeah? So whether the disorder of autism is in the brain or in consciousness, I would argue, I don't know what I would say. Can I not answer the question? I think I already said a lot. Yeah, because I could say, as a philosopher, I would say, yeah, it's a disorder of world-brain relation, but that's metaphorical. Yeah, so please be more concrete, not. That's why I say, please allow me not to answer the question. That's why I turned off the mic now. Yeah, okay.
Yes, so my apologies if you already made a distinction, but do you believe there's a difference between the mind and the brain? For example, can the brain be viewed as a hardware and the mind like some kind of software where it can have different expressions depending on the structure of the physical brain itself?
Yeah, I know that has been long a metaphor. Hardware, software, in philosophy, this has been sort of called functionalism. I defy that. So I don't think that the brain, you can make a clear distinction between hardware and software. Or in the neuroscience terms, it would be between the structure and the functional level, the anatomical structure, and here's the functional level, which you heard from me today. That's not a distinction because the structure, the supposedly hardware, is extremely flexible. Your structural connections, if you juggle for half an hour, your structural connection change. So there's no clear distinction between structure and functional language and slash hardware software, if you extend it to anyone. This is one of the reasons I think ultimately you need a concept and matter which is ultimately by itself indifferent to the distinction between structure and function. Yeah? And that's, I think, one of that is this time-space dynamic. Same way, you need a measure which is indifferent, intrinsically indifferent, to the distinction between neuronal and mental. Yeah? If you have a purely intrinsically neuronal measure, by default you will not go to the mental. Yeah? You have a discrepancy, you have a gap in that, built in, purely methodological. Yeah? Yeah? For me, this methodological thing is really, really important. Yeah? So, if you start, I have this discussion with a phenomenologist. I love phenomenology. I did my master's about Merleau-Ponty phenomenology and philosophy. Yeah? But they say, okay, we start just with consciousness, just with mental phenomenological stuff, and we don't go beyond. Yeah. By default, they have a gap to the brain. They will never be able to close it. So that's why I say you need a concept which is indifferent to the neuronal and the mental. That's why I speak of common currents. That's a strategy. And if I have that, then I don't need the concept of mind anymore. Yeah? I just don't need it anymore. It's superfluous. It's nonsensical. Yeah? It's just, I don't need it anymore. It has no explanatory value. Yeah? But I don't deny consciousness. Don't get me wrong. I believe you all your experience and that you're fed up with my response.
Perhaps an example of that be in a dream state if you're able to have lucidity, like you're in a dream state, but then you have some kind of conscious control of awake to be lucid observationally at the same time as an experience.
Yeah, that's the dream state is such a difficult thing. It's really, you already touched upon this before, I think it was you. I have a cooperation with a sleep researcher. And what we're currently trying to do, we have some data where before they fell in love, they get certain scenes. And then we want to see how these contents resurface in their dreams. So basically, the point I want to make is that even in dreams, it's an internal experience, but you're still somewhat aligned to the world. But it's just a shift on your internal external continuum. Yeah? So it's just a shift. That's why you still... So one of the questions I have for the dream is, so why is it possible that within dreams, you still experience features of the external world? You don't have access to that. Yeah? So maybe your internal external continuum is still somewhat preserved, but it's sort of shifted towards the inside. Yeah? That's why you still have real life experiences. So in Salvatore Dali pointed that out in a spatially distorted way. Yeah? Salvatore Dali painted many of his paintings. So when he fell asleep, and then he built himself somewhere that he immediately woke up, could recall his dreams, and then he painted. Yeah? And then he came to the idea with the clocks and all that stuff. So you still have the same contents in dreams as in the outside world. Yeah? You have firemen, you have this, you have that. But you experience them in a spatially distorted way because your space-time dynamics is somewhat altered. And we are trying to investigate that now with the... there are some very interesting data where we indicated that we use the fractal oscillatory distinction components in the power spectrum. Maybe the fractal dimension is specifically altered in dreams. Yeah. But that sort of that gives you this abnormal space-time structure.
You're saying before that for you the self is more basic than consciousness.
Yeah.
But then what about small babies who maybe are not thinking to have a sense of the self, but they are at least animated beings or they are some kind of...
I knew I should have not said this. I knew in the moment I said it, I knew it will haunt me. I sensed it. I know. Because to be honest, I just don't. I mean, you could also make the point here, not of what is this? You show scale-free properties for self and for consciousness. Yeah, what is this? It's the same thing? No, I just don't know. I really don't know. What I'm sure is that the self is not necessarily conscious. So self does not entail consciousness. And what I mean by self is not usually, when you speak of self, you might, I recognize myself in the mirror. I mean by self, you navigate in a self-perspectival way in the environment. Yeah? I think I said this morning, I have schizophrenic patients who are highly intelligent, they cognitively know everything, but they couldn't find their room in the ward because they simply could not develop a perspectival coordinate scheme to go into their room. Yeah? So they couldn't decide where to go because they lacked this default spatial perspectivity, subjective perception of space, construction of space. Yeah? That's for me self, perspective. So it's not this, I am aware, or I am thinking, therefore I am. No, I don't care about all of that. Yeah? Yeah, much better if you don't do that. That's what I mean, this basic, completely common sense intuition by default navigating in the world. Yeah, that's what I mean, what I call self-relatedness. You relate to the world. Yeah, so in that sense, that doesn't necessarily entail consciousness. And I would say, so that's for me prior and more fundamental to consciousness. How that is related to consciousness, we did one study in these vegetative state patients and coma patients where we applied self-related stimuli, own name versus other name, and we saw that particularly the decrease in the activity in response to the own stimuli predicted the level of consciousness. What does it tell you? I don't know. It's philosophically, it's a mess at the end. So.
We have to, sorry, Krista, maybe last question.
Okay. Have you ever spoken to people that have temporal lobe epilepsy? Because I have temporal lobe epilepsy, and many of the ideas that you're talking about resonate with an experience of someone that has that condition. So the aura, sort of pre-seizure and post-seizure after being unconscious, it's very much about this pattern world connection of your brain patterning to connect with the exterior world. And I just wonder if you have talked to anyone that suffers from temporal lobe epilepsy about these ideas.
Yeah, so I have seen several patients who reported me these things, and it's well known that particular temporal lobe epilepsy have also this mystical experience and unification with the world and godlike experience sometimes. I don't have actually, it would be interesting to have these kind of measures I'm applying to these patients.
Yeah.
It's an interesting study. So if you give me a data set on that, I'm happy to do that. Yeah, no, it's all about the data. You need the data and the person. Maybe there's something online. Would indeed be an interesting, particularly if you compare that with schizophrenia, because there's an overlap. Schizophrenia is well-known medial temporal lobe hippocampus.
Yeah.
So same thing, yeah? That would indeed be an interesting thing. I agree.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I'm happy that you're here, that you can connect to that as somebody who knows some of this personally, because that means I'm not wrong. Because
it's really interesting. Yeah, because
so,
you hit on some points that are very, like once you pass the sense of self through an aura when you're descending into a seizure, then you get all this patterning. So it's you are very aware of the sense that your brain is working to connect you. It's like being in a like how you said it just works. Your brain is working to make everything fit.
Right.
Yeah. When you're, that's what consciousness is doing for you.
Right.
Kind of, and you feel that experience quite clearly.
Okay.
Right before you become unconscious. It's interesting. I think maybe too some people with stroke talk about when they're experiencing a stroke, kind of similar sensation.
I very much appreciate the openness and also the, because for me I consider that a big compliment. If my theories are phenomenologically in violation to your experience at all.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So for me the phenomenology is driving. That's where I go into psychiatry. So some of these physiological ideas come because I often ask my question, it's a very Kantian way of approaching this, how must the brain function in order to bring forth these kind of experience? Yeah?
Yeah, because things like scale, and someone like Lewis Carroll had temporal lobe epilepsy, so Alice in Wonderland is very exemplary of that thing of where things seem very tiny, or things seem very huge, and you know that the brain does this sense of scale thing all the time.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so let's close the seminar here. But I think I'm very happy to chat with all of you, and thank you very much for this very interesting talk.
Thank you.